statement, the Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, sir, with permission, I wish to make a statement on the outcome of the inquiry into the disclosure of certain information in my honourable and learned friend, the Solicitor General's letter of the 6th of January. As the House knows, the Chairman of Westland Public Limited Company, Sir John Cuckney, wrote to me on the 30th of December 1985, asking whether Westland would no longer be considered a European company by the government if a minority shareholding in the company were held by a major international group from a NATO country outside Europe. This question was of fundamental importance to the company in making its decision as to what course it was best to follow in the interests of the company and its employees. It was therefore essential to be sure that my reply should be in no way misleading to anyone who might rely on it in making commercial judgments and decisions. The reply was accordingly considered among the departments concerned, and the text of my letter of the 1st of January 1986 was agreed in detail by my right honourable and learned friend, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, my right honourable friends, the then Secretary of State for Defence, and the Chief Secretary of Treasury, and finally by my honourable and learned friend, the Solicitor General. My letter was made public. 2 days later, on the 3rd of January, my right honourable friend, the then Secretary of State for Defence, replied to a letter of the same date from Mr. Horn of Lloyds Merchant Bank, asking him a number of questions, covering some of the same ground as my own reply to Sir John Cuckney. The texts of the letters became public that same day. My right honourable friend's reply was not cleared or even discussed with the relevant cabinet colleagues. Moreover, although the reply was also material to the commercial judgments and decisions that would have to be made, my honourable and learned friend, the Solicitor General, was not invited to scrutinise the letter before it was issued. On the morning of the 6th of January, my honourable and learned friend, the Solicitor General, wrote to my right honourable friend, the then Secretary of State for Defence. He said, and I quote, "It is foreseeable that your letter will be relied upon by the Westland Board and its shareholders. Consistently with the advice I gave to the Prime Minister on the 31st of December, the government in such circumstances is under a duty not to give information which is incomplete or inaccurate in any material particular." He went on, and I continue to quote, "On the basis of the information contained in the documents to which I have referred, which I emphasize are all that I have seen, the sentence in your letter to Mr. Horn does, in my opinion, contain material inaccuracies in the respects I have mentioned, and I therefore must advise you that you should write again to Mr. Horn correcting the inaccuracies." That is the end of the quotation. But I have quoted extensively from the letter, and as honourable members know, it was published a week ago. As I have already indicated, it was especially important in this situation for statements made on behalf of the government on which commercial judgments might be based, to be accurate and in no way misleading. That being so, it was a matter of duty that it should be made known publicly that there were thought to be material inaccuracies. Which needed to be corrected in my right honourable friend, the Member for Henley's letter of the 3rd of January, which, as the House will recall, had already been made public. Moreover, it was urgent that it should become public knowledge before 4 p.m. that afternoon, the 6th of January.
Order.
Cuckney was due to hold a press conference to announce the Westland Board's recommendation to shareholders of a revised proposal from the United Technologies Corporation Fiat Consortium. These considerations were very much in the mind of my right honourable and learned friend, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry.
Order.
When the copy of the Solicitor General's letter was brought to his attention at about 1:30 p.m. that afternoon of the 6th of January, he took the view that the fact that the Solicitor General had written to the then Secretary of State for Defence and the opinion he had expressed should be brought into the public domain as soon as possible.
Order.
He asked his officials to discuss with my office whether the disclosure should be made, and if so, whether it should be made from 10 Downing Street, as he said he would prefer. He made it clear that, subject to the agreement of my office, he was giving authority for the disclosure to be made from the Department of Trade and Industry if it was not made from 10 Downing Street. He expressed no view as to the form in which the disclosure should be made. Though it was clear to all concerned that in the circumstances it was not possible to proceed by way of an agreed statement. My office were accordingly approached. They did not seek my agreement. They considered, and they were right, that I should agree with my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, that the fact that the then Defence Secretary's letter of the 3rd of January was thought by the Solicitor General to contain material inaccuracies which needed to be corrected should become public knowledge as soon as possible and before Sir John Cuckney's press conference. It was accepted that the Department of Trade and Industry should disclose that fact, and that in view of the urgency of the matter, the disclosure should be made by means of a telephone communication to the Press Association.
Order! 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 Prime Minister.
I should have said that a different way must be found of making the relevant facts known. The report finds, in the light of the evidence, that the Department of Trade and Industry acted in good faith in the knowledge that they had the authority of their Secretary of State and cover from my office for proceeding. An official of the department accordingly told a representative of the Press Association of my honourable and learned friend, the Solicitor General's letter, and material elements of what it said. The company was also informed. The information was on the Press Association tapes at 3:30 p.m. Mr. Speaker, my right honourable and learned friend, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, was in my judgment right in thinking that it was important that the possible existence of material inaccuracies in the then Secretary of State's defence letter of the 3rd of January should become a matter of public knowledge, if possible, before Sir John Cuckney's press conference at 4 p.m. that day. Insofar as what my office said to the Department of Trade and Industry was based on the belief that I should have taken that view had I been consulted, they were right. My right honourable and learned friend, the Attorney General, has authorised me to inform the House that, having considered the report by the head of the civil service and on the material before him, he has decided, after consultation with and with the full agreement of the Director of Public Prosecutions and Senior Treasury Counsel, that there is no justification for the institutional proceedings. For the institutional proceedings under the Official Secrets Act in respect of any of the persons concerned in this matter. In order that there should be no impediment to cooperation in the inquiry, my right honourable and learned friend had authorised the head of the civil service to tell one of the officials concerned, whose testimony would be vital to the inquiry, that he had my right honourable and learned friend's authority to say that, provided he received full cooperation in his inquiry, the official concerned would not be prosecuted in respect of anything said during the course of the inquiry. The head of the civil service did indeed receive full cooperation, not only from that official, but from all concerned. My right honourable and learned friend tells me that he is satisfied that in no way interfered with the course of justice. On the facts as disclosed in the inquiry, there would have been no question of proceeding against the official concerned.
Mr. Kinnock!
Mr. Speaker, after persistent efforts, we have managed to pull a statement from the Right Honourable Lady. It had, Mr. Speaker, a detail produced not by frankness, but by guilt.
Yeah.
Heavy and unerasable guilt. And that stain will stay with the Right Honourable Lady for as long as she endures in politics. Her excuses, Mr. Speaker, are completely implausible. She cannot justify or excuse the conduct of her government in any one respect. In this squalid story, we've been told that the leaking of the Solicitor General's letter was authorised. Authorised by her office, connived in by her office, all, says the Prime Minister, with her subsequent endorsement. We have to ask the Prime Minister, especially given her personalised and centralised style of government, where was she on January the 6th that she couldn't be contacted on a matter as basic and essential as this? She has a duty to tell the House what she was doing when her office, as she says, was getting on with the business by themselves. We've been told, Mr. Speaker, that the matter was authorised. What was actually authorised was a conspiracy by people in the Department of Trade and Industry and people of her office to disclose certain parts of a letter written by a law officer to another member of the Cabinet about a matter of important public business. That was their way, we are told, Mr. Speaker, of putting it into the public domain. That was the route chosen, not by open means, but by subterfuge, by dishonest means, Mr. Speaker. We have been told that there was an inquiry. Indeed, there have been answers in this House from ministers, including the Prime Minister, saying that an earnest inquiry was being undertaken in the normal fashion. We have to ask, why was there an inquiry when everybody knew very well what was involved? Inquiry when everybody knew that there would be no prosecution because the dispensation had been given. Mr. Speaker, the only comparable precedent with this act of contrived insincerity is the way in which Macbeth so fiercely looked round for the murderers of Duncan. Mr. Speaker, we hear from the Prime Minister. That an immunity was offered. Why was that the case when it was plain that there was to be no prosecution? We have heard a shabby story, an effort to defraud the public, and the fact is, Mr. Speaker, that the Prime Minister, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, and everybody else involved would have got away with it, was it not for the fact that in this democracy, ultimately the Prime Minister had to make a statement. They would have got away with it, and what they would have done is to deal with the former member of the Cabinet, the Secretary of State for Defence, not by the means available to the Prime Minister, if she believed that he was acting contrary to the national interest, not by sacking him, but by trying dishonestly, covertly, to subvert him. That is a profound dishonesty, Mr. Speaker. For the government to leak in order to inform and influence public opinion, that is normal. For a government to leak in order to discredit anyone is shameful. For a government to leak in order to subvert a member of that government is the action of a government that is rotten. Not just rotten to the core, but rotten from the core. And they should go.
Order. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, in reply to what the Honourable Gentleman says, much of which I totally reject. First, as he has seen from the Solicitor General's letter, the government had a duty to give accurate information and not to give any misleading...
Order!
Because that information could be used upon which to make commercial judgments. Because there was a possible inaccuracy, it was important to get accurate information into the public domain in time for the meeting at 4 o'clock. I agree that it should have been done, as I indicated, by a more correct method. The fact is that I was not consulted, as I indicated in the statement. Yes, I did. I did institute an inquiry. And the Right Honourable Gentleman would have been the first to castigate me if I hadn't. And would have accused me of being frightened of one.
Order.
Yes, I instituted. Yes, I instituted.
Order. 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 I order. I say to the House that the Leader of the Opposition was heard in silence. Order. Order. The Prime Minister deserves a fair hearing.
Mr. Speaker, I did institute an inquiry on the 14th. It started on the 14th of January. I instituted an inquiry to find the full facts because the full facts were not known. The inquiry reported on the 22nd of January, and I have made a full statement today on the 23rd of January.
Sir Edward Gardner.
Would my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, not agree that if, as appears to be the case, my right honourable and learned friend, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, had been aware or been made aware of what he believed to have been misleading information which could have damaged seriously the future of Westland, then would he not have been under an overriding and imperative duty to correct that misleading, to protect Westland from further damage, and that if he had not fulfilled that duty, he would have been failing in his duty as Secretary of State?
Speaker, I believe my honourable and learned friend's analysis is the correct one. The government had a duty to see that no misleading statements were made, and therefore possible inaccuracies had to come into the public domain at the relevant time because commercial judgments were about to be taken.
Sir David Steele.
Is the Prime Minister aware that her whole statement reveals a yet another chapter of shabby and astonishing behaviour in the higher reaches of her government? Does she recognise that she also owes this House and the civil service an apology? She's allowed 9 days of a charade of an inquiry to get going when she could have cleared the whole matter up by calling in her colleague, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, and her own press officer in 10 minutes. Will she answer two specific questions? Why was the Solicitor General not told that his letter was going to be used in this way?
Right.
Why was her colleague, the then Secretary of State for Defence, not told that the letter was going to be made public? And why, if it was so important to make the matter public, was there not a clear government statement of policy rather than this hole-in-the-corner method used? Is she finally aware that if she were living in the real world outside and had conducted this inquiry, she'd now be on a charge of wasting police time?
No, Mr. Speaker. The inquiry, in fact, was set up to establish the facts, and it did establish the facts. And had I refused the demand for an inquiry, again, the Right Honourable Gentleman would have criticised me, and the inquiry established many facts which were not known to me. The Right Honourable Gentleman says now I could have done it without an inquiry. That's not what he would have said had I failed to embark upon that course.
Alex Fletcher.
I'm aware that there are members on this side of the House whose first consideration in this matter is the integrity of government. And is she satisfied?
Order! Order!
Satisfied that the statement she has made this afternoon has enhanced the integrity of her government.
Mr. Speaker, I have tried, having set up an inquiry, having received the full report yesterday, to give as full an account as I possibly can, because the House deserved to have it.
Mr. Michael Foot.
Does the Right Honourable Lady recall that a week ago, when I asked her the question, she said the inquiry was going ahead, but it was not the custom in any sense at all to make a report to the House, and she was not going to do so. When she gave that answer to the House, and when she drew the veil that the inquiry was going to proceed, she must have known all the facts. She was conceding them from the House and the country. When is she going to apologise for that?
No, Mr. Speaker. The Right Honourable Gentleman is not correct. I did not know all the facts, and that is why an inquiry was set up. It is not the usual tradition or custom to give the outcome of these inquiries. There have been rare exceptions when that has been the case. One such exception was on the 1st of July 1976, when the results of an inquiry were published and there was a statement made into disclosure of information regarding child benefits. When I got the result and the report of this inquiry, I knew full well that it would have to be one of the exceptions when a full statement would have to be made. I have made such a full statement because that was what the House wanted and required.
Mr. Michael Colvin.
Would my right honourable friend agree? Would my right honourable friend agree that if we need lessons in leaking, we have only to read the Crossman and Castle diaries, from which we would learn that previous Labour governments leaked like sieves.
Mr. Speaker, I think that a different way would have occurred had there been more time. I think honourable members should remember that there was a time constraint. It was urgent because of that meeting at 4 o'clock that afternoon.
Merlin Rees.
You're aware that as I've listened and watched this tawdry saga rattle on, I no longer care about the relationships between trade and industry, miners and industrialists. I no longer care whether the machinery of government is being run properly. All I know is that if as Home Secretary I'd set up an inquiry and they came back and said, but sir, you authorised it, I'd have resigned.
No, Mr. Speaker. I have, in fact, in a long statement, given the facts. I hope, given the facts indicating that I was not consulted, I hope the right honourable and gentleman will have the decency to accept that statement.
Mr. Heseltine.
May I ask my right honourable friend that if I, what I said in the letter, which was apparently so difficult, caused such concern, as it was in the hands of the Number 10 and the Department of Trade and Industry on the Friday afternoon, and there was no protest from colleagues about its contents, and as the first I heard of concern was late on the Saturday night when the Solicitor General told me that he would be writing on the Monday, would it not have been possible for colleagues to have considered and discussed and perhaps even agreed any withdrawal of anything in my letter that was misleading? But may I ask my right honourable friend, as I did respond to the Solicitor General, and as the text of his letter has been published, would it not be now right for the text of my reply to be published as well? And will the Prime Minister accept that every word of the letter that I sent to the European Consortium stands uncorrected by any statement by this government?
Yeah. I think the problem would never have arisen had my right honourable friend cleared his letter with the Solicitor General, because upon the basis of that letter, commercial judgments would have been made. He did not do so. He knew full well that I had cleared every word of mine, and of course because it was thought that it might be included in a prospectus or be material to it. Had he cleared his, this problem would never in fact have arisen.
David Owen!
The Prime Minister now tell the House when her office told her that they had given cover to the Secretary of State's office to reveal this letter. Was it the 6th? Of January? Was it the 7th of January? Which date, and why did she not come and tell this House as soon as she knew that her office had been involved in this leak, and how can she continue to hold the high office that she does when she constituted a leak inquiry in the full knowledge that her office, and by implication she herself, was fully involved in this whole sordid affair?
Mr. Speaker, I do not think that the right honourable gentleman has taken fully into account every single thing in my statement. the inquiry was set up to establish the facts. An enormous number of the facts were not known to me, were not known to me until yesterday when I got the result of the inquiry, January the 22nd.
Mr. Cranley Onslow. Order.
My right honourable friend will be aware that many honourable and right honourable gentlemen opposite, like the right honourable gentleman who's just intervened, are not really interested in listening to the facts of the full and frank report which she's given to the House. But may I ask her what view she thinks the House might have taken of any minister in any government placed in such an invidious situation by the action of a colleague who had failed in his duty to ensure that correct information was made public as soon as possible.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, it would have been much easier, as the facts were commercially sensitive, if the relevant letters had been cleared, as was mine, with the Solicitor General. It is because we knew that judgments may be founded upon them and the government could be liable if wrong judgments were made as a result of misleading information, that it was vital to have accurate information in the public domain. It was to get that accurate information in the public domain that I gave my consent.
Jack Dormond.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister said that there's an open decision taken by number 10 to release the letter to the Press Association. Did she see Mr. Chris Moncrief on the 9 o'clock news of television last night, who said that there wasn't any way in which he was going to reveal where it came from, who it came from, or any other details of it? Is she not aware that Mr. Moncrief, there is no more honourable member of the press gallery than him? Why would he say those words in contradiction to what the Prime Minister has told the House this afternoon?
I do not believe that there is a contradiction. I have set out the full facts as a result of the inquiry. I have set them out extremely carefully and accurately, and I hope that the Honourable Gentleman will consider them with the same care as I have given to expressing them.
Mr. Nicholas Fairbairn.
Speaker, will my right honourable friend appreciate that this is probably the House of Commons at its worst?
Order! Order!
When political parties who hope to obtain power in this country and destroy the prosperity that our government has created, wish to make bogus points, pretending they are matters of principle, should they not go and consult their consciences?
Mr. Speaker, I repeat again, the inquiry, the report of the inquiry was submitted to me on the 22nd of January on the basis of the report of that inquiry, which contained most of which facts were new to me. On the basis of the report of that inquiry, I have faithfully reported to the House.
Mr. Roy Jenkins.
Honourable Lady aware.
Privy
is the right Honourable Lady aware,
the Privy Councillor,
that as she and her government sink deeper into the bog of deceit and chicanery, almost her only remaining memorable words will be, there were commercial decisions involved, and that previous governments, prior to her own, have been actuated by higher considerations than this.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I note what the Right Honourable Gentleman says. But when commercial decisions on different reconstructions are made on the basis of a prospectus, legal obligations follow that the information shall not be misleading. And I would have hoped that the Right Honourable Gentleman might have accepted that.
Mr. Mr. Patrick Cormack.
When the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry addressed this House at length last week, did he know that he'd authorised this leak?
Mr. Speaker?
Order.
The inquiry was underway. The inquiry has now reported, and I have given the facts.
Mr. DL, Tam DL. In other words,
when did the Prime Minister's press office first tell her what they had done?
Speaker, I have given as full of an account as I possibly can. Account, the inquiry I established so that they could establish the facts. I have indicated that I was not consulted at the time.
Sir George Gardner.
Will my right honourable friend take it from me, as one who worked as a political correspondent in this building for 13 years, that the events in the
Order
of Trade and Industry that she has outlined differ not one jot from the regular practice of Labour members when they were in government? And will she further take it from me that if there is anger and criticism on these benches, much of it concerns the way a comparatively straightforward issue is being blown up into such grotesque...
Mr. Speaker, it was the duty to see that accurate information on a commercially sensitive thing was in the public domain that the decision was taken. I've indicated that I was not consulted at the time. I did set up an inquiry to establish the facts. It has established them.
Mr. Jack Ashley.
In view of the exchanges this afternoon, does the Prime Minister consider that in 6 months' time she will still have the same team?
I'll be there.
And does she really think that she will still be captain of the team?
Yes, sir.
Mr. David Crouch.
Mr. Speaker, I wonder if I may make a comment as a backbencher who has never really understood the working of the official or the unofficial channels, nor the difference between an official statement or a statement attributed to a spokesman. And may I say to my right honourable friend that I think that this information that was released was of such importance that it should have been released at that time by whatever means.
Mr. Speaker, I think my honourable friend is making a comment on the practice of non-attribution. I accept that there are a lot of comments that can be made about that.
Mr. Madden.
Will the Prime Minister, who has always sought credit for being a Prime Minister who is always on the job, now answer one simple question? When was she told by her officials of their involvement in agreeing to the disclosure by the Department of Trade and Industry of the Solicitor General's letter?
Mr. Speaker, a vast number of the facts in that report. I am trying to answer it. Well, to me until yesterday. I am not going to tease out what was and what wasn't. A large number of the facts in that report were not known to me until yesterday.
Order. Order! I have to bear in mind we have business questions after this, and this is an opposition day with two important debates. Order! I propose to allow questions to go on for a further 10 minutes. Mr. Teddy Taylor.
There may be some on both sides who would think in this fast-moving situation a public statement would have been preferable to an official leak. Wouldn't it be wrong to allow disagreement from this to distract us from the simple fact that thousands of jobs could have been put at risk if the government had allowed the board to go ahead with making a decision on the basis of conflicting advice from different departments? And now we've had all this disclosed, should we not simply let Westland get on with the job?
I agree with all three points in my honourable friend's statement about the public statement and, of course, now letting Weston get on with the job.
Joe Ashton.
I think it's so blatantly obvious that this whole episode has been conceived to
get rid of the Honourable Member for Henley, whose job was filled inside 10 minutes of him leaving the Cabinet, would the Prime Minister now tell us exactly what he did wrong to merit such treatment?
Perhaps the Honourable Gentleman has forgotten that my Right Honourable Friend took his own decision.
Mr. Stokes!
Is my Right Honourable Friend aware that I was in my constituency on Friday and Saturday and met a very large number of people...
Well done, John.
...in all walks of life...
Order!
...to mention the Westland case to me. Is she further aware that in my postbag I have not received a single letter on the subject? Has the matter therefore not been blown up by the press and the media and also seized on by the opposition who are short of ammunition against the government?
I heard two-thirds of what my honourable friend said and agreed with it wholly. I'm sure the other third was marvellous too.
Mr. Winnick.
Prime Minister aware that instead of the robust fighting statement we were promised today through her, by her to the press, what we've had today instead is a shoddy, pathetic statement that will convince no one, certainly not most people in the country, but gives a perfect illustration of a deceitful way this government goes about its business. And is the Prime Minister further aware, Mr. Speaker, that while we're all pleased, of course, that no civil servant is going to be used as a scapegoat, it's quite obvious that if the Minister concerned, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, had the least idea of what honour meant, he would have resigned by now.
Mr. Speaker, I think the Honourable Gentleman omits the fact that I deliberately set up an inquiry to establish the facts. He has established the facts, and I have reported to the House upon them within a day of receiving that report.
Mr. John Wilkinson.
Seeing, Mr. Speaker, that it was the clear collective decision of the government before Christmas that the future of Westlands should rest with the decision of the shareholders and of the company, how come that my right honourable friend, the former Secretary of State for Defence, should be writing this extraordinary letter to the chairman of a merchant bank that was acting on behalf of one of the parties, the potential rescues? And wasn't it in this situation entirely right for the law officer concerned and my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Trade and Industry, to take extraordinary measures to give the true and accurate facts?
Speaker, it was a unique situation. I believe my right honourable friend had a duty to see that the facts were available at the relevant meeting. It would have been better if we had all followed the same procedure during this difficult period and cleared our letters with other departments, and during this period of great sensitivity cleared them also with the Solicitor General.
Brian Gould.
Has this not now become, on this issue and on many others, a government where the mere assertion of prime ministerial power and patronage is deemed sufficient to sweep aside issues of principle and honour?
No, Mr. Speaker. Indeed, I would. There would be some who would allege that prime ministerial power was not, in fact, sufficiently evident at certain parts of this interview.
Keith Hampson, Dr. Keith Hampson.
Mr. Speaker. Is my right honourable friend aware that all members of the House would prefer to have accurate information put into the public domain, as she expressed it? But in order to make sure the information was accurate for the shareholders Westland, would it not have been better, instead of a small part of the Solicitor General's letter to be leaked, to do the most damage to a colleague, if indeed there had been a delay so that his answer, which the Solicitor General accepted, the evidence which indeed the Solicitor General asked for, could then also be released so the shareholders could make a proper judgment?
Mr. Speaker, I think it is essential to get into the public domain the fact that there were possible inaccuracies which were relevant to that situation. I accept at once that it would have been better had the statement been made or that information been released in a different way.
To Dick Douglas.
The Prime Minister has given us certain detailed information, Mr. Speaker, as to the factual accuracy of what happened. But could you help me here, because I'm a layman and not a lawyer, but as I understand it, the Solicitor General its expertise is in legal matters. What vital legal consideration was at stake on this issue? And did the Solicitor General himself know that his letter was going to be leaked?
Mr. Speaker, in the letter which I quoted, which is now has been for a week, as he knows, fully in the public domain, the Solicitor General said, in respect of what my right honourable friend, the then Secretary of State, had written, it is foreseeable that your letter will be relied upon by the Westland Board and its shareholders. Consistently with the advice I gave to the Prime Minister, the government in such circumstances is under a duty not to give information which is incomplete or inaccurate in any material particular. That is because of the prospectus point.
Mr. Dale Campbell-Savers.
Is the Prime Minister aware that when the people of this country in the future examine these days, they will say that the Prime Minister did not tell the truth?
Hear, hear.
Is the Prime Minister aware that in 1963, Mr. Profumo, in admitting to the House that he had deliberately misled
or
be in contempt. He admitted his contempt. And would the Prime Minister now not accept that this matter is best dealt with by the Committee of Privileges of this House, who are in a position to find out the nature of the contempt that has taken place?
No, Mr. Speaker, I totally reject and resent the honourable gentleman's assertion.
Mr. Norman St. John Stevens.
The Prime Minister aware that whatever the faults of the government in handling this situation, and there have been grave faults, nothing justifies the farrago of hypocrisy, humbug, and cant which we have had to endure from right honourable and honourable members of the government.
Grateful to my right honourable friend. Throughout, I have thought it absolutely vital that as Westlands had the choice, they were able to make that choice on the basis of accurate and not misleading information. That will continue to be our policy.
Terry Davis.
Does the Prime Minister think that it should need an inquiry for her to learn what has been authorised by a member of her cabinet?
Mr. Speaker, had I attempted not to have an inquiry and say I'll do it internally, honourable and right honourable members opposite would have been the first to criticise.
Sir Douglas Hogg.
Right honourable friend, the Prime Minister accept that the general judgment will be that we've had a full and candid statement.
That
it was clearly in the national interest and in the interest of the company that the information should have been disclosed. That all we're talking about is the manner of the disclosure. And that is essentially a trivial and minor matter. Would my right honourable friend also accept that the electorate will not easily forget those who perpetuate this matter out of narrow personal or political interests?
Mr. Speaker, I am grateful to my honourable friend. I had only one thing that I could wish, that the manner of disclosure had been different and more orthodox.
Mr. Nigel Spearing.
The Prime Minister has told the House that the Secretary of State for Industry authorised what she called material elements in the Solicitor General's letter and not the whole letter. She said that this was covered by Downing Street. Can she tell the House to whom Mr. Ingham is accountable and who decides his standing orders?
Speaker, I have looked carefully at the statement and I asked the honourable gentleman to look carefully at the statement to see what was agreed and what was accepted. It was drafted absolutely in accordance with the report which I received. And I like to say that Mr. Ingham has served successive governments with great devotion and dedication, and I have great confidence in him.
Mr. Jerry Wiggin.
Not mention it in her statement, but can we take it that the writer of the letter, the Solicitor General, did give his approval in advance that parts of it should be selectively leaked to the press?
Mr. Speaker, no, sir, and I deeply regret that.
Mr. Tony Banks.
The Prime Minister has said that she feels that the information in the letter could somehow have been made public in other ways than through a leak. Will she say what ways she thinks it should have been given to the press?
Mr. Speaker, it is now a hypothetical question. The alternative way would have been to have made a straight statement. As the Honourable Gentleman knows, times were not easy. Things were not easy at that time, but also we were the people concerned, I say again, I was not consulted, were up against a very severe time constraint, as I've indicated in the statement.
Mr. Patrick Nicholls.
Speaker, does my rather honourable friend not find it remarkable that the opposition's indignation on the question of leaks is quite as selective as it is? Why, for instance, don't we hear something about the leak of that letter of Sir Raymond Ligo to the right honourable gentleman, the member for Henley? Doesn't it in fact come to this, that all this hot air amounts to the fact that if a leak is thought to damage the government, the opposition want to highlight it? If it isn't going to damage the government, they'll ignore it completely.
Repeat again, I'm grateful to my honourable friend, but I believe it was right not to have potentially misleading information at a time when very important commercial decisions were about to be taken which involved the future of a particular company.
Bowkes.
Speaker, would the Prime Minister give the House an assurance now that when she has teased out the details as she described them, she will tell the House exactly when she was told of her office's involvement in the disclosure?
Mr. Speaker, I set up an inquiry to find out the facts. I discovered most of the facts when the inquiry had been reported.
Peter Horton.
Is it not the case that for very many years past, the people who stand in greatest danger in this place are lobby journalists being run over and tripped up by cabinet ministers and others trying to tell them secrets? And of course, it would have been better to have made an open statement at the time, but are we not making far too much fuss about a tiny company about the size of a moderate hotel in North London, and is it not time we got on with some proper business?
Because I understood it, we had a clear duty to see that accurate and not misleading information was in the public domain at the time. My right honourable friend carried out that duty, and I agree that his judgment of getting it into the public domain was right, as I indicated. I did not like the way in which it was done.